This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We've been talking about America's healthcare costs for years. We spend more than any other advanced nation, and our economy's health depends on getting that under control, something that is proving to be a significant challenge. Some say our healthcare system is simply broken. But as you will hear in the next hour, we don't really have a single system. We have many different systems serving different constituencies in different ways. And despite that, or perhaps because of it, our outcomes fall short of other industrialized nations. In fact, in the list of other Western nations that put healthcare in reach of most, if not all, of their populations, we rank 30th for life expectancy. Last week, I hosted a program for the Learning Society at Queen's University of Charlotte, seeking to get the perspective of three healthcare professionals in our area on how we might improve. Dr. Don Jonas, Ph.D., is executive director of CareRing, which provides health services to at-risk populations in our area. He's also an adjunct professor at the Blair College of Health at Queen's. Dr. Jordan Lipton is a physician and co-founder of Signature Healthcare and Signature Pediatrics, Charlotte's first concierge medical group. And Dr. Dan Murray is chief medical officer of the specialty practice division for Optum Care, which brings value-based care delivery platforms to specialists. He's also an orthopedic spine surgeon and previously a founder and CEO of Ortho Carolina. We spoke in front of an audience sprinkled with other healthcare professionals.
As we go through the hour, we hear some of the things that you're going to say, the three of you. How many of your colleagues will take issue with what you say here tonight?
Well, we'll find out. I see several of them in the audience tonight. I think that's part of the challenge is that healthcare is such a big part of our lives, a big part of our economy that everybody sees a different facet of it. But it's really hard to take a step back and see the big picture of some of the primary drivers that are affecting what we experience day to day. So hopefully we can step back and look at some of those.
Well, who knew that healthcare could be this complicated?
Turns out.
So, Dr. Lipton, the U.S. spends more on healthcare as a percentage of GDP than any other advanced Western democracy. And yet, you say, our results are, and when you measure them by outcomes, are poorer. Do patients know that?
I don't think they do, for the most part. I think that patients are focused on, obviously, access to care and access to their doctors, not necessarily their primary care doctors, of which there is a shortage, but access to specialists. And people think that if they're seeing a specialist or they're seeing their doctor, they're getting the very best care available, and that's not always true. Not because the physicians aren't doing a great job, but the system isn't set up for it.
Do policymakers know that?
They probably do, but I couldn't tell you.
So why then is it more expensive with poorer outcomes? What is it about our system that just doesn't serve us well?
I think that there are a lot of problems. One is the cost of administration of healthcare in this country. You know, most countries, of course, have a single payer universal coverage, which, as I told a few people before, I'm going to upset a lot of people when I talk about that, even Dr. Murray here. but we spend somewhere between 16 and 30% of our healthcare costs go to administration, insurance administration, that sort of thing, whereas other countries spend closer to 5%.
Hmm. Who does it really well? What country that has a different system does it really well?
I like the Canadian system for personal reasons. I grew up in Canada, but I'm a big fan of the Swedish system and the Taiwanese system. I think there are three different types of universal coverage. One is a completely socialist healthcare system, in which case the physicians and the hospitals and the clinics are owned by the government and paid for by the government. The other is a health insurance system, like in Canada and Sweden and Taiwan, where it's more where the government administers the or collects the fees and administers them, but the doctors and hospitals and clinics are all privately run and private individual physicians. And the third is a multi-payer system that has basically negotiated uniform rates, which saves a lot of money on administration. But I like the middle type the best.
So, Dr. Jonas, whenever we have these discussions about healthcare in America, they're always connected to politics. It's always a political discussion, or it quickly becomes one. Can we divorce medicine and healthcare from politics?
I don't think so. I don't think in this kind of environment where we're so divided, as a population and as parties, it's extraordinarily difficult to find common ground. I had to follow up on what Jordan's comment before when you were talking about the different healthcare systems. Every one of those is in the United States, right? So if you're a veteran, the payer and the provider is all one. You're in the National Health Service, right? If you're over 65 and you're on Medicare, you're living in Canada. If you are in the employer-based system, you are in some version of Germany or some of the other Western European countries. And then if you don't have any insurance, like 140 countries out of the world sort of pay as you go, you're uninsured in America, which in right here in North Carolina, 100,000 or so people are like that. So it's just a curious, when you talk about how complicated it is and how difficult it is and how we would come to a political solution around this, we have the most complex system, this non-system in the world to try to navigate through.
It's a non-system, so how did it become that way? How is it that England and Canada and Sweden and Norway and all these other countries have figured this out and the greatest country in the world has not?
Well, they had the political will to decide that they wanted to come up with a system to provide adequate, affordable care to everyone. And so they did it in lots of different ways. You heard parts of that. We fell into this system as a result of World War II. You know, we had 10% of the population that was receiving insurance before World War II started. And the War Labor Board said employers can't add salaries to their staff, but they can give them a benefit of receiving insurance. So we saw in the 1940s, the percent of the population that was receiving health insurance through their employer exploded, went from 10% of the population to 50% was receiving it through their employer. And that became the way we thought you provide health care in the United States. And so we've been living in this structure that really intellectually doesn't really make much sense. Why would you not receive it from your YMCA or from your church or from somewhere else? But we've created a system built around that. And so it's very difficult for us to break out of that mental model that that's the way to provide health insurance.
Of all the systems that he talks about that we have operating in this country, the VA system, the Medicare system, what else did you talk about? The uninsured system where you go to the emergency room. Which works the best? Which has the most benefits? Which has the better outcomes? Any of them?
If you want to look, I mean, to be honest with you, if you look at the Medicare data, the place that has the best outcomes will surprise you. It's Kaiser. And that is a staff model HMO where they are both an insurance company and a provider. And so much like, you know, you talked about a single payer system, the thing that's different, though, is that people have chosen to opt into the Kaiser program. It works very well in California, where it has grown up. It has failed in other markets in the country. And I think what that speaks to is the heterogeneity of America, that the countries that you talk about were much smaller than America when they made that decision and much more homogeneous. And it's really hard to find ways to meet all of the disparate needs and values that we have in this country without having more than one system to play. Now, I'm not saying it's a good system, but I think that gets to the root cause of why it's been so hard to get to a single system.
How much of it also has to do with our firm commitment to free market capitalism versus being more open to socialism?
We don't have free market capitalism in healthcare because in a free market, you would know what you're paying for. Well, you would know what it costs.
Take the free market out of it. Just call it capitalism. How much of it has to do with that versus our antipathy toward?
We don't really have capitalism because there's barriers to entry because we have certificates of need that don't allow us to open up new centers. There's a lot greater regulation that makes it more of a regulated economy than a free market economy. So it's really a myth in my mind that we have actually free market capitalism in healthcare. What we don't have is proper incentives. And if you ask me, that's really what's wrong with the healthcare system.
And we're going to talk about that because I'm big on incentives. But you're the Canadian in the room here. Canadians are capitalists. What's wrong with you people? What happened there? How did that happen?
Even in this country, we are already spending about 52, depending on what you read, 52 to 60% of our healthcare system is funded by taxes. And that applies to, you know, that includes Medicare, the VA, federal employees, and Medicaid, as well as tax incentives to employers who provide health insurance to their employees. So I don't think it's too much of a stretch to basically keep the doctors private and capitalize capitalist, keep the hospitals private, capitalist, but have the government pay for it. And increase taxes a little bit. I think it would actually it would decrease the cost for 95% of Americans. It would include everybody, and it would provide better care.
So according to the Commonwealth Fund, which carries out independent research on healthcare issues, Americans don't appear to use more healthcare than anybody else in the world. In fact, we go to the doctor less often than people in other parts of the world and are hospitalized less, but we pay more for the things that we use. Is the part of that because patients and sometimes doctors don't have a clue what things actually cost?
Yes.
I think that's
And why is that? I mean, I know that Blue Cross Blue Shield says they've been trying to be more transparent by posting the costs of procedures and things like that, but it's still difficult. And I had a doctor ask me what I paid for a procedure that I had done and asked me to bring in the bill from an area hospital so he could see it because he was on their cost committee and had no clue what that procedure cost. Why is that?
It changes. It changes from day to day, from month to month, with insurance companies. It's very, as you know, Dan was talking about the disparateness of the system, and you'll pay half what you would pay in Charlotte, in Raleigh, or in other parts of North Carolina for the same test and for the same procedure.
I think we need to be real precise with our language. You asked how much does it cost. You didn't ask what was the price.
Right. Okay. Right.
Mm-hmm. So they're very different. The costs are determined by what it costs to actually provide the service. The price is what you end up getting charged. The price is all over the map, and it's largely determined by leverage more than anything else. I mean, right now, the price of virtually anything you get in healthcare is based on how much leverage the negotiator of contracts for that particular entity had. It's not based on the quality. It's not based on anything other than that.
But is that because it's insurance-based or insurance-driven for the most part, or is there some other force at work here?
Well, the providers set their own prices, and for the most part, they accept insurance. And insurance negotiates on the behalf of their of the patients that are covered for a discount on whatever the fee schedule is that the provider has. So the fee schedule may be, you know, $1 million a piece, but they negotiate a price of $2,000 for it, and you get written off the $998,000 unless you happen to be uninsured, in which case you get charged $1 million. Right? Is that?
That's right. Yeah, so docs don't know what it costs, and patients don't know what it costs. I mean, have you ever looked through the explanation of benefits bills that come?
Oh, yes.
That's gibberish. I have no idea. It's communication between the doctor and the insurance that I guess they have to send it to me, but I don't have a clue what it is. My daughter over the Christmas break had to have an appendectomy. We just got to have it done. Went and had it done. Bills are just flowing in. I don't know what they were for. I don't know how they were calculated. I think it was based upon the charge master who looked at my particular insurance and that kicked out a particular amount of funds that I had to pay for. Nobody in our system, the providers or the recipients, understand what it actually, the real price is to provide care.
We're talking with physicians and healthcare professionals about the state of the American healthcare system. Our guests include Dr. Don Jonas, Executive Director of CareRing, Dr. Jordan Lipton, physician and co-founder of Signature Healthcare and Signature Pediatrics, and Dr. Dan Murray, Chief Medical Officer of the Specialty Practice Division for Optum Care. Our conversation was recorded last week for the Learning Society at Queen's University of Charlotte, and we'll have more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the cost and quality of healthcare in America with local physicians and healthcare professionals. Our guests include Dr. Don Jonas, Executive Director of CareRing, Dr. Jordan Lipton, physician and co-founder of Signature Healthcare, and Dr. Dan Murray, Chief Medical Officer of the Specialty Practice Division for Optum Care. Our conversation was recorded last week at Queen's University of Charlotte for the Learning Society, and before the break, we were talking about the exorbitant cost of healthcare and the fact that no one, including doctors, really knows what things actually cost in the system. I made the example that when you take your car in for service, you get an itemized bill. I asked the panel why we as consumers put up with this lack of transparency and why we don't demand more accountability with regard to healthcare costs. Dr. Jordan Lipton answers first, followed by Dr. Dan Murray.
I think patients and physicians are too busy to try to figure it out and to try to argue about it. It's just there are other things to do. You've already had the stress of a medical issue. You don't want to have to argue with as long as it gets paid and you're not bankrupt, which unfortunately does happen a lot.
Well, look, I mean, a sixth of our economy, quickly becoming a fifth of our economy, is based on health care. There are a lot of people who are making or who are doing really well with the system the way it is. And so if you're talking about upsetting the status quo of a sixth of the economy, it is hard to get your voice out there.
We have this fee-for-service model in most of America, and some believe that that incentivizes healthcare providers to provide tests, procedures that perhaps patients don't really need, but it does make money for hospitals, and it does make money, I guess, for insurance companies. I don't know, and certainly for physicians. Some have suggested we'd have lower costs and improved outcomes by setting up the pay structure differently. What would that look like, and why haven't we done it? And I know you want to talk about this, Dr. Murphy.
I do. If I can take a step back, when I started med school, healthcare was 9% of GDP. It's now 18%. And if you're not an econ major, what that means is 9 cents out of every dollar in this economy that used to be spent on roads, education, refrigerators, and vacation, and everything else we care about is now spent on healthcare. And I would argue, one, I'm not that old, and two, we're not a lot healthier than when I started med school. So I don't have any other conclusion but to say that there are a lot of people who are making money on things that don't add value to the patient's outcome or their experience, because otherwise it wouldn't be increasing as a proportion of the economy. And it's roughly double what all other industrialized countries are in terms of percentage. The reason for this, I think, it does come down to incentives. We're incentivized to do more. We're not incentivized to make you healthy. We're not incentivized to keep you healthy. And so if I am paid, so I don't think it's people who are blatantly ordering things that they know you don't need. But if I'm in a system where if I order something and I don't pay for it. Nobody, to my knowledge, nobody pays for it. We don't know what it costs. And it might help. Then I have this push to go ahead and do that. If I were in a system where the patient or I were paying for it, then I might think about it differently if I wasn't sure it was going to help, or if I thought it was only a 50-50 chance of helping. I might make a different decision about how I framed it to a patient, right?
We should have an ethicist on the panel, because my next question is, you physicians took the Hippocratic Oath, which says do no harm, and if people walk away bankrupt, they've been harmed.
I agree. I think we underestimate. We don't think in terms of financial health. We think about physical health and mental health and to some degree emotional health. But we need to add that to the facets we think about.
So when you were CEO of Ortho Carolina, you adopted something called a value-based model there as opposed to fee-for-service. And you adopted, they adopted something called bundled payments, which I tried to understand this afternoon but couldn't. So you can tell me what it's all about.
So you said nobody knows what they pay for the service they get, and they don't know what outcome they're going to get. That's what a bundle payment does. Your insurer, on your behalf or with you, with your deductible, will pay a fixed amount up front, and that's all you pay. And so, for instance, if you need a total knee or a total hip, we've negotiated a deal with your insurer. They're going to pay us as the physician a certain amount, and it's our job to negotiate with the hospital, with physical therapy, with anesthesia, and with anybody else that you're going to need during that three-month period after your during and after your surgery to give you that care. If we do a bad job or you have a complication, you don't pay for that readmission. I pay for that readmission. So I'm incentivized to make sure you don't have a complication and that you don't have a readmission. And so I may do things differently, like I'm going to make sure that the care plan is followed. So I'm going to have a care navigator that I pay for in my practice to make sure that you have all the information you need, that your family is well educated about what process should happen. And if there's any deviation, you call us first rather than going to the ER. I'm going to do all of those things to redesign the care so that ultimately what happened in our bundles is that the complication rate was cut in half and the cost was 30% less. And that's a good outcome in my mind. You know, you pay less, you get a much better outcome. And the physicians actually were more engaged in your care. So it turned out to be a more satisfying experience because you had more support during that episode. To me, that aligns the incentives correctly so that I've got skin in the game to make sure that you get better. And, you know, you're better, you're more engaged, and we're kind of in it together. Now, you have to work with the insurers to make sure that you're not taking what we call actuarial risk, so that I shouldn't have to pay for if you get hit by a car on the way home. You know, that's not necessarily the piece that I'm paying for, but anything that's related to the surgical procedure itself or expected complication, that's included. So it frees us up to be more innovative in how we go about taking care of you. And you could look at it and say, well, why didn't you do that before? Well, before the incentive, and it's a reasonable question, and I posit that question a lot with my colleagues. But the reality is we've been incentivized for a long time to just keep doing more, not to take a step back and redesign the system. And in fact, if we took a step back and redesigned the system, that's work that is altruistic, but we actually lose money for doing that because we can't be doing the things that we get paid for.
And we've done a lot of talking in this country about cost of healthcare, and I'm not sure that it sinks into a lot of people because I think a lot of people, as you pointed out, Dr. Jones, are insured through their employer and have been for most of the 20th century and most of the 21st century so far. And by that, you go in and you pay a deductible or you pay a little overage here and there, but you don't pay the full freight. Is that part of the problem? We don't understand what it means not to have insurance. We don't understand what it really costs to do these things.
I think that's part of it, yeah. So it's we know we've got this. If you're employed and you have employer-based insurance, then that's sort of taken care of. It's something you don't need to know the cost because you have some level of comfort that you're taken care of. The problem is that type of a system doesn't work in the type of United States that we have today. We have lots of small businesses, and we have individual entrepreneurs, and we have uninsured people that aren't eligible for public or private insurance. So that sort of island, that works really well if you're in it and you're receiving that sort of care. You don't care about the cost. I didn't care when my daughter got the appendectomy because I knew I'd eventually the insurance would cover the vast majority of it and I could cover the little bit that was there. But that's not what it's like for particularly the people that we care for.
Plus deductibles keep rising. It's not just a $10 copay or a $30 copay and but you have to wait sometimes till you meet your $5,000 or your $10,000 deductible. That's when people begin to notice that this is real money,
yep.
Which makes it all the more curious as to why there was so much gnashing of teeth over the Affordable Care Act, which was highly derided by a big segment of the population until they tried to take it away. Tell me what was wrong with the Affordable Care Act, Dr. Lipton.
Well, I know that the Affordable Care Act it differed in every state and every county of every state. So, for example, in Mecklenburg County, there were very few, at least in the second year of the Affordable Care Act, there were very few possibilities available, and they were exclusionary. Plans, meaning you could not go to see any doctor. You could go to see the physicians or hospitals that were under CHS or Atrium, or you could go to Novant. And therefore, if you had a cardiologist from Carolina's healthcare system, and you had a Novant plan, you could no longer see that doctor without paying out of pocket.
Right.
So it did not address some major issues. And in fact, a lot of people who qualified for subsidies still couldn't afford to get health care.
So if you don't have insurance in America, as you have pointed out, Dr. Jonas, you pay as you go or you go without health care, which is where your organization, Caring, comes in. That's two words. That's care and ring. How have your patients been impacted by changes in the Affordable Care Act, first by the establishment of it and then by changes of it and the possible end of it?
Yep. So a lot of the folks that we were seeing at Caring became eligible for subsidies on the marketplace. So the way it was set up was that if you were at roughly 100% of the federal poverty level up to 400% of the federal poverty level, you could receive a subsidy. In some cases, the closer you got to 100%, almost a full subsidy. So we saw a lot of folks that moved away from us. It's great. They went off and they got private insurance. What we also saw though, was that a dramatic increase in people that were very poor. That in the state of North Carolina, currently, that we chose not to expand Medicaid, and the folks that were making below 100% of the federal poverty level weren't eligible for any kind of subsidy. So you had this, the poorest of the poor were eligible for nothing in our state. And so we saw to where it is today, our clinic in Uptown Charlotte, about 85, 90% of the folks we see are at 100% of the federal poverty level or below. So they're very poor, they're not eligible for Medicaid, and they're not receiving private insurance where they work. So we saw a dramatic increase of very poor people, which also, they're oftentimes very sick people. They've delayed getting care for a long time, so that by the time they come to see us, the majority of people have multiple chronic diseases that we're trying to address after they've gotten to us, and it's more challenging.
And how much, I'm just curious how much of the cost of healthcare, if our healthcare has gone up so dramatically in the last decade or two, how much of that is because we have uninsured people? How much of that is because we have too many uninsured people and we're not doing preventative healthcare on them and others, for that matter? How much of it is due to that?
I don't know what the percentage is, but I do know that obviously, you know, having a system in which everybody's insured would reduce the most expensive cost of care, which is emergency care. And that's not just uninsured, but that's also for the underinsured. A lot of people will delay, even if they have insurance, they'll delay treatment because they figure they've got a $5,000 deductible and they won't seek out care until it's an emergency, right, in which case the costs are quadrupled.
I mean, one of the contradictions that we have is that we have made the decision in this country that everyone has a right to health care, and yet we don't rationally fund it. And when I say that, we've decided that if someone shows up in the ER, they can't be turned away. So if that's the law, then that means everybody is entitled to health care, at least at an emergency level, right?
And I don't think people understand that, because
I understand.
We've had these discussions before the Affordable Care Act was passed. We had discussions with just ordinary people in Charlotte, and I asked them, is healthcare a right or a privilege? Some said it's a right. Many said it was a privilege.
Well, whether you think it's a right or a privilege, it is the law that you cannot be turned away. And so we've decided legally that everyone is entitled to health care. We've also decided we're not going to pay for it in a rational way at all. And so, yeah. So you know, if you fall into these different categories with insurance or without or whatever, then you're going to be treated differently. But everybody's going to get some care. Now, I think the Affordable Care Act was an attempt to make sure that there was some more rationality applied to it. And had the Supreme Court not ruled that states had the option of not expanding Medicaid, had that not happened, then we wouldn't have the exclusion that Don was talking about. So essentially, everyone other than undocumented individuals would have been covered. And when that decision was made by the Supreme Court, that's when it started to gut the efficacy of universal coverage and rational payment.
And because health care is a right, and because you can't be turned away, taxpayers pick up the bill, right? We're already paying for it.
At some level. I mean, certainly we're paying for Medicare and Medicaid. We also have subsidies for nonprofit health systems and multiple other ways in which there are benefits to the system because we take care of indigent patients.
How are we paying for Medicare? Because people pay in to Medicare through their payroll deduction, and once you go on Medicare, you have to pay premiums just like you would pay Kaiser or Aetna or Blue Cross. So how are taxpayers paying for Medicare?
Well, there's probably an economics professor in the room who could explain it in greater detail, but essentially when Medicare was started, I forget the number, but it was something like 50 people were paying for each individual, and now it's down to 2, I think. And so we're obviously not putting enough in to actually fund what it's ultimately going to cost. So the money I put in today, if we keep going the direction we're going in, is not going to cover the ultimate cost or the price of the services that I receive.
Could I have one thing? I agree everything that Dan said, but the one thing I wanted to add on of the emergency room being an access point, that's truly just to stabilize the person. There's no requirement ongoing that they're going to become healthy. And unfortunately, what occurs is lots of people do figure out that they can go to the emergency room, but they're back out on the streets. and they don't have access to their meds, they don't have a primary care place, they don't have a specialist to visit, they end up coming to us, or they come to one of the docs to help them work with this.
Are most physicians in favor of changing the insurance system or the medical system, the health care system? Are they in favor, say, of a single payer system, or is it just the three of you?
I don't even think it's the three of us. I think I may be the only one here. But I think that most physicians, I think most Americans, when they hear the term single payer system, I think they're worried about a communist, you know, socialized
right.
medical system,
yep.
and you know, long lineups and long wait times and whatever. But it's been shown in all other, you know, all of our peer economies that outcomes are better and the costs are lower with a single
payer
system.
Well, you say that a single payer system would lower costs for 95% of Americans and would eliminate insurance premiums, copays, and deductibles. There would, however, be a small tax increase.
Correct. That's where the 5% that don't benefit from it come in.
Is that where the thing goes off the rails? Because we don't like taxes in America.
I think that's part of it. But it really, you know, quite honestly, compared to what we're paying now, it truly would be a small tax increase.
So that would offset the $5,000 deductible or the $10,000?
It would offset all that. I think there have to be, you know, I think with any socialized system, and I refer to Sweden regarding, you know, with this idea, I think we would need to have some disincentive for overusing the system, because we know, for example, with Medicaid, that there's a lot of overuse of at least there used to be before they had to pay $5 to show up at a doctor's office. I think there needs to be some disincentive for going to the doctor every day for a toothache so they can get a note for work. But I think you'd eliminate, and that would take the form of a small copay, a trivial copay, so you don't waste everyone's time. But I think that we definitely would get rid of most of those out-of-pocket expenses that everyone hates.
We're talking about how to fix America's healthcare system with doctors and healthcare professionals, recorded last week at Queen's University of Charlotte. Our guests include Dr. Don Jonas from CareRing, Dr. Jordan Lipton, physician and co-founder of Signature Healthcare, and Dr. Dan Murray with Optum Care. More in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking with physicians and healthcare professionals about the problems in the American medical system. Our guests are Dr. Don Jonas from CareRing, Dr. Jordan Lipton, physician and co-founder of Signature Healthcare, and Dr. Dan Murray with Optum Care. Let's get back to our conversation, which was recorded last week at Queen's University of Charlotte.
I don't know how many patients actually come to you and say, I want a knee replacement, but I know a lot of people come to you and say, I want that pill I saw on television last night. Let's talk about drugs and pharmaceutical companies. We often hear that Americans pay the highest prices for drugs of any consumers in the world. Why?
Because there are no negotiated rates for pharmaceuticals and medical devices in this country, except when it comes to the VA.
You mean at the federal government?
At the federal, yeah.
So the Congress has said that Medicare and Medicaid can't negotiate on behalf of its client base with pharmaceutical companies. Every other country that I'm aware of does, and that's how they get far lower rates, because that's a pretty big volume discount.
But drug companies already complain that they don't make enough money for research and development. They have enough money to run ads on television, but they don't have enough money for research and development. So if we started paying lower prices, we're obviously footing the bill for research and development. What would happen to that? Where would it go? Would it end?
The Pfizer stock would slow down a little bit.
I know more about the implant company than I do the pharmacy.
Okay.
Implant companies spend between 5% and 6% on R&D. They spend about 40% on marketing.
Wow.
So you decide what would happen.
Americans we're impatient. We like quick fixes. We want that antibiotic if we get the sniffles, even though the antibiotics don't help the sniffles. We want the pill that we saw last night on TV, because that's going to fix our problem, as opposed to eating better or exercising. We want that pill. Does that help drive up the price of drugs too? Because we want them.
I think it drives up the price of healthcare, whether it drives up the cost of drugs in particular, I don't think that's necessarily the case. But it definitely drives up the cost of health care.
How much of the cost of health care is wrapped up in medical technology? Because now we have MRIs and CAT scans and all these amazing things that we can do, but the machines themselves cost a lot of money to develop and buy.
And to read the studies.
Yeah. How much of this is wrapped up in that?
I think medical technology, including prescription drugs, is a huge cost to our system compared to other, our peer nations.
Well, in countries, our peer nations that have single-payer healthcare systems, do they have the same devices, the same access to those devices?
They do, but as Dan pointed out, they're more judiciously used. So they're not everybody's going to get an MRI for knee pain. They're going to get an MRI for knee pain after they've done some physical therapy.
But does it matter? Because life expectancy in this country is lower than most Western countries, and we have all the whiz-bang stuff. Does it matter that we don't get that MRI when we need it, when other countries don't get them when they need them and they're living longer?
I agree.
I'm just asking.
It doesn't matter.
In fact, there's been a lot of work done to show that getting more testing often leads to more complications because you identify things that you have to follow up on, and actually in doing the biopsy for the thing that was found that turned out to be benign, you actually do damage. There are tons of examples of that. But I think, and frankly, as a spine surgeon, getting MRIs on a lot of people with back pain led to a lot of surgery for degenerative discs. And it turns out that it is normal to have a degenerative disc. If you're an adult, half of you are going to have a degenerative disc if we did an MRI of your back. That doesn't mean you have any pain, or any pain that you have, even if it is degenerative, is coming from that. And if I do surgery on you, I can guarantee you I will make you worse. I can guarantee you. And so, but I get paid for that, for doing that. And so if I were paid differently, where I didn't get paid if you didn't get better, I might have a different conversation you about it. Not that I'm doing it just to make a lot of money, but, the incentives matter.
Well, let me flip the coin on avariciousness here and talk to Dr. Jonas about something that I don't think a lot of charlatans are aware of. You have a program at Caring that operates with Atrium, Novant, and Ortho Carolina, and it involves, I understand, half of the physicians in Charlotte, and they give health care to poor people to the tune of $17 million last year, and I think $150 million in donated services and things in the course of 10 years. Is this happening in every market in the country?
It's not, and Dan and some folks in the audience are familiar with it. It's called Physicians Reach Out. It's a program that was borrowed from Asheville on Project Access. So it was a way that, if you had any one physician that said they wanted to take care of someone that didn't have insurance, that's great. But the collective power of having all three of the major hospital systems and independent providers coming together, it's quite extraordinary. So it's really the only access point for someone that doesn't have public or private insurance to get access to specialty care in Mecklenburg County.
And the $17 million that was donated in services and equipment and time, et cetera, last year, is that enough? Or are people still falling through the cracks?
Yeah, no, people are still falling through the cracks. So that reaches about 3,500 to 4,000 people a year. But we've got the latest data I saw, 65,000 people that do not have public or private insurance in Mecklenburg County right now. But we've got these great relationships. It's one of the few things where the hospital systems have been working together really well for over 10 years now. It's over $150 million worth of donated care. We have a new arrangement with the Levine Cancer Center. So the folks that we screen and we are able to show that they don't have access to any kind of insurance, we have unlimited appointments into the Levine Cancer Center. So I can point to last year 84 individuals that had a cancer diagnosis that were not being cared for except occasionally going to the ER. They're now actively being managed through the oncologist at Levine Cancer Center.
Let's talk about hospitals. We have two major nonprofit hospitals in this area. Atrium used to be Carolina's Healthcare and now Novant, which used to be Presbyterian. They're in competition with each other. Why do hospitals compete? Doesn't that raise costs?
Yes.
I know you were afraid of talking about the hospitals. We have people in the audience in the hospital system. But Atrium recently planned to merge. They didn't want to call it a merger, but they planned to merge with UNC Healthcare, and they called that off a couple of weeks ago. And some people said that we dodged a bullet there from calling that off. Blue Cross Blue Shield said it was going to raise costs because it would give them greater leverage to say how much they would pay the insurance company. Should we be trying to make money from healthcare? That's why they want to have these mergers, to make money, right? So should we be trying to make money from healthcare?
I'll take this one. I think health systems that are nonprofit owe it to the community to behave as if they are nonprofit. Now, we can all talk about what it means to be a nonprofit, and everyone may have a different definition. If I go back to my grad school economics, it would say a 3% profit margin to maintain your infrastructure is typical for a nonprofit entity. If you look at regulated entities like the electric company, they would have a certain cap on their profitability, and the rest would be given back in reduced fees. I don't see a lot of systems coming back to the payers and saying, you know, we took too much, we give it back. We have excess revenue, which is the code word for profits, and that gets put into building new buildings and expanding and all of that. And I get it feels good as a community to keep expanding our healthcare. But the reality is, it's not like other businesses. We shouldn't want more healthcare, right? We should want to be healthy so that we don't need more healthcare. And so I would love to see a system that was less focused on how profitable we are and more focused on how much we're improving the health of the community. And I think people are starting to get that. I think the health systems are starting to understand that the new way that people are going to be judged is less about how profitable they were and even how much revenue they brought, but more about whether the baseline health of the community is being elevated or reduced as a result of their activity. Now, a lot of this crosses over with social determinants of health, and certainly Don sees this more than any of the three of us, that the social service network and human support network that people have determines people's outcomes probably more than anything we do as physicians. And so there's a lot to be said for rethinking the way that we split up these resources in the economy. And I think thinking about new health payment models that actually pay you for making people healthy or keeping people healthy, and this isn't just preventive health. This is actually thinking in terms of your outcomes. I'm going to pay you based on outcomes, or I'm going to let you be in our network if you have better outcomes. And that means that you're able to function better, or you have less pain at the end of the year than you did at the start if I'm an orthopedic surgeon, right? So based on whatever I treat you, whether you had surgery or not, I should be evaluated based on whether your outcome is better, not based on what I did to you. And I think if health systems can grab that and move in that direction, then we won't be having this conversation about profitability.
Are they doing this in single-payer companies? Are they concerned about outcome to keep costs down because it's everybody gets seen?
In single-payer countries?
Yes. Well, in countries that have single-payer
their
systems.
Outcomes are better. I mean, they're, you know, by the
main... Is that by design
or is it
happenstance?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I've mentioned primary care. I do feel that even though it's true, it's wonderful to have a primary care physician, you know, corresponding with the specialist to determine the best course of action for a particular patient problem. I still think that we need more primary care providers to do the preventive stuff, that vaccinations, education, all those things are so important, and those are definitely major determiners of outcomes.
Right.
I don't disagree with you on that.
Okay. Well,
So there's a doctor named Saul Weinreb, who's an obstetrician gynecologist in College Park, Maryland, who wrote an opinion column last month in February in a publication called The Hill. And he suggested we could lower costs, medical care costs, in four ways. Stop practicing defensive medicine and the ordering of expensive, unnecessary tests, procedures, and medications. Reduce unnecessary paperwork for physicians, I guess. Switch to disposable... switch from disposable to reusable instruments and better manage surgical supplies. And he believes that doing all these things would save billions of dollars every single year. Do you think he's right?
I don't know about the disposable instruments.
That kind of skeeved me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some of those elements. I mean, I think the malpractice piece tends to get overplayed, and we as physicians like to trump it up and talk about how bad lawyers are for the system. The reality is economists who've looked at it closely would only attribute 1 to 1.5% of the increase in cost to our medical legal system. Now, there'll be people that argue with that, but I think it has a lot more to do with how we behave. I do think some of the things he talks about are important. I will tell you that in the data that we've analyzed, there are simple things like changing where care is delivered that can have a huge impact. In fact, 3 to 4% of GDP could be taken out of the spend if we only did procedures on people at sites of service that were lower cost. So something that could be done in an ambulatory surgery environment that's done in a hospital. Something that's done in a tertiary care hospital could be done in a community hospital, or something done in an ASC that could be done in the office. Just doing that, there's actually about 15 to 20% of the total healthcare spend, not just surgical spend, total healthcare spend, that could be reduced by optimizing that.
This is so complex, it's got tentacles everywhere. But if you were the healthcare czar, give me one thing that you would recommend that we do, or two things that we would recommend doing right now. I'd like to hear from all three of you on that. Go ahead, Dr. Jones.
There's a lot of things. I mean, we've talked about it here, is that focus on prevention. I mean, there is so much literature out there now on early intervention, early in a child's life, proven outcomes for little ones. One of the programs that we have at Caring is we have nurses that go into the homes of young moms that are pregnant for the first time. And I know that those little ones there's a much greater likelihood they're going to be born full term. There's a much greater likelihood that the mom is going to finish high school and get into the workforce. And there's a much greater likelihood that the little one that's born into poverty is going to break the chains of poverty 15 years later. So I guess the one thing I would do is just, there's so much evidence, and we know it works to help people that are in poverty through a healthcare intervention with a nurse, but it really goes into the social determinants of health piece we talked about before. I'd put my thumb down on that.
Dr. Lipton.
I would agree with everything that Don just said, but I would also say universal coverage with a focus on primary care and prevention along those lines. That way there are no people in the system that can't afford health care.
Dr. Murray.
I would say change the system to pay us based on whether you are better rather than based on what we do.
And would your colleagues buy into this?
I think that would be a great start. I think the system is so complex, as you said, there are tentacles everywhere. I think you can't boil every single patient problem into one disease state that can be posited as a value-based medicine, but that'd be a great way to start without having to change our whole system.
Well, thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you. Thanks.
That concludes our conversation with healthcare professionals, recorded last week at the Learning Society at Queen's University of Charlotte. We spoke with Dr. Don Jonas, PhD, as Executive Director of CareRing, which provides health services to at-risk populations in our area. He's also an adjunct professor at the Blair College of Health at Queen's. Dr. Jordan Lipton is a physician and co-founder of Signature Healthcare and Signature Pediatrics, Charlotte's first concierge medical group. And Dr. Dan Murray is Chief Medical Officer of the Specialty Practice Division for Optum Care, which brings value-based care delivery platforms to specialists. He's also an orthopedic spine surgeon and previously a founder and CEO of Ortho Carolina. For Charlotte Talks, I'm Mike Collins.